Hello, everybody. I'd like to thank Bill for letting me be on this webinar. And I'm going to talk about critical race theory. But really what I want to do to do it is walk into it, because what I'm trying to do is get people to reframe how to understand Marxism. Of course, I'm not going to make the argument here that critical race theory kind of borrows from or is in some way related to Marxism. I'm going to make the argument that it's the purest form of Marxism. And if you don't know that, you don't know. And that's a real big problem. And if you go down the block and somebody you see in their church is teaching critical race theory because, you know, we got to go along to get along, what they're doing is they're negating their own faith. And that's a discussion I don't know how far to go into, because that brings up stuff I'm not going to bring up in critical race theory unless we have a chance. So I have a funny little thing here. If I want to look at Bill, I'm looking down at this screen. And if I want to look at the camera, I'm looking here. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to back away from the screen as soon as I start this briefing. The first thing I want to say is this reframe of Marxism and then putting critical race theory. Actually, once you put critical race theory, it makes a lot of sense, but you might scratch your head and then want to replay this in 3 days and you'll see it. This is hard stuff and you have to really think about it. So I have to give myself an alibi here. A lot of people know I've been going through chemotherapy, and I just literally had the plug pulled for me about 4 hours ago, and my mouth is a little bit numb. That's just a side effect from chemo, but if it sounds like I've been drinking a lot, sorry, I can't even do that till the chemo wears off in a couple of months. So I just ask you to kind of grin and bear it, and if I kind of dwell on a point, I apologize for that, but I think we could get this going. One of the things I'd like to point out, and I think I'm going to hit a slide to do this, but I'm going to back away right now so people can see the slide. And Bill, I will make these slides available. I know you sent, you got the whole deck at one point, but what I kind of cut this one down for briefing today. I want to hit a couple topics here on critical race theory before we go in. One's of course the fair use. We're doing fair use, and the second one is, if you take a look at it, this is the entire construction of the briefing. And what you're getting is part seven. It's called demonstrative example intersectionality. And of course, intersectionality is just another way of saying critical race theory. And we'll get to that. Now, as part of the lead, and what I like to point out here is I like this quote because it comes from 1884. And it was written by a book in 1884 called Contemporary Socialism. And it borrows from a quote from the 1840s. And I think this is such an important quote because it lays down a marker, because this is about the time Marx is still spinning up his theory. The masses can only be gathered under the flag of negation. And what are they negation? They only exist to destroy your worldview. Now, in the ancient world, that was called critical race theory, okay? I mean, excuse me. The flag of negation, what that really means is what they want to do is destroy your culture. And in the German, they call that Aufheben der Kultur among the Marxists. But if you translate it a certain way, it can be translated as cancel culture. So anything that's on the other side of this type of criticism only is there to be negated. So the masses can only be gathered under the flag of negation. We shall have deserved well of it if we stir hatred and contempt against all existing institutions. We make war against all prevailing ideas of religion, of the state, of the country, of patriotism. The idea of God is the keystone of a perverted civilization. It must be destroyed. The true root of liberty, of equality, of culture, is atheism. A revolution is never made, it makes itself. This is something I think is so important, because at the cornerstone of all Marxism, from the very beginning and at all times, has been the destruction of a belief in God. Now, I'd like to expand this because it's not just a Christian God, it's the Jewish God. Actually, it's the Islamic concept of God. But what do I mean by that? If you ever go to the CW, that's the station your kids watch, which has this bubblegum science fiction. They have all these gods that they emulate and stuff like that. That's okay. And I'd like you to think how much that's accepted. The Transformer creatures, which are kind of very close to the ancient gods, if you really think about it, they're tolerated. It's only the transcendent nature of God that is not tolerated. And it's not tolerated because The transcendent concept of God is the God that exists outside of his creation and outside of time. And that's the object of attack, and that's been true from the very beginning. Now, this whole briefing fits into a concept of something we call political warfare. And by that, we mean the Maoist insurgency model. And I just love this quote. I put it in every brief because I'm telling you, the Chinese know this about us. Al-Qaeda knows this about us. Everybody knows this about us. Whether it be the intrusion of hackers, this is from 1999, two colonels who wrote their thesis in the Chinese War College. Whether it be the intrusion of hackers, a major explosion at the World Trade Center, or a bombing attack by bin Laden, all these greatly exceed the frequency bandwidths understood by the American military. This is because they have never taken into consideration, have even refused to consider means that are contrary to tradition, and select measures of operation other than military means. What are they saying? Americans don't understand strategy, and they're never going to figure it out. So here's a quote from Lenin. I take it right from his book, because we're basically arguing to talk about Marxism, you have to understand dialectical materialism, which is a form of dialectic. And for those people who say, oh my God, we work really hard to avoid that, I get it because it's very hard. But I also have to tell you, studying Marxism without understanding the dialectic is like studying football and never seeing a football field or a football. It just can't be done. And so the dialectics, as Lenin said, dialectic is the theory of knowledge of Hegel and Marx. It is the aspect of the matter. It is not an aspect, but the essence of the matter, to which Plekhanov went on and he goes on and speaks there. So what I'm trying to say is that we need to understand that. So here we take a look at this concept of the dialectic from a Hegelian point of view, and I won't belabor this. All I want to point out is that there's three legs to the dialectic. The dialectic itself, the idea that science, something called the science of reason, what is that? All it is the idea that my views and my opinions are scientific. And therefore, if you disagree with me, you're stupid. And therefore, I don't have to respect you and I don't have to tolerate you. And in fact, because you persist in your stupidity, I could treat you like dirt. I think that now resonates with people. And then, of course, it all goes to the concept that the state is God, okay? The state is God. This is what Hegel argued, and this is what Germany was unified around. So let's just take it. I just had one picture. That's Hegel. Boom. Here's Marx. And what do you see? The dialectic turns into dialectical materialism. The science of reason turns into scientific socialism. Our concept of science of socialism is scientific. And because we're right, if you disagree, you're wrong. And, you know, we don't have to tolerate you. And it's the all-powerful state. So think about it. All the powers we're giving to the state. Think of the COVID narratives. And think about the fact that half the time our medical leaders say something officially, it's wrong. Well, you could say, don't they understand what they're doing? And I would argue, yes, they do understand what they're doing. They can say what they want because what they say is true because they reflect the power of the state. And you might say, Steve, that's pretty arbitrary. And I'll say, yes, you need to understand that the all-powerful state has the right to be arbitrary because if it's God, it tells you what's scientific. And if you don't agree, you're an idiot and we can take your rights away. It might sound coherent there. So here you have the picture with the average citizen in the middle. And this is how it works. First, you have this idea that in the political warfare fog, you're just strategically disoriented. You may not recognize the threat, and you might not even recognize there is a threat. And you cannot articulate it because all these things here are hidden. They're fogged in. You don't see them when it's executed as part of a Marxist alignment. So I just want to give that impression to you as we go to intersectionality and hit this briefing. So here you see some of the main books on intersectionality, which are also critical race. And what you see here is intersectionality is as critical social theory. So we're going to look at what critical theory is. And I think a lot of you know critical theory is what the Frankfurt School called their concept when they emulated Marx's critical philosophy. And of course, you have critical race theory right here. Intersectionality is what we called a minute ago science of reason. Science of reason, remember, is our opinion is science, and therefore you don't have the right to disagree. And if you do, you're wrong. We don't have to respect you. So I want to give you the $10 word, science of reason. And all it is our views are scientific, and if you disagree, you're stupid. Okay, intersectionality of science of reason construct that facilitates critical theory objective of cultural level dialectical negation. Or as they're saying on the street, destroy the culture. I'm just forgetting the term. Okay, so dialectical negation of the targeted population set. So what we have here, let's take a look again. You see the FBI here. The FBI is now holding weekly intersectionality workshops. Well, if we're showing that critical race is Marxism, the FBI is teaching it, why are you surprised that they basically have determined that Antifa doesn't represent a threat and are not even looking at it? It's kind of scary if you think about it. You'll take a look at the critical race theory, and that's Kimberly Crenshaw, who's right here in the intersectionality workshop. So I just want to show you that when you start to look at this, it really is overlapping. So intersectionality is a science of reason construct that facilitates critical theory. And let's take a look at this. An intersectional analysis considers all the factors that apply to an individual in combination rather than considering each factor's isolation. So we have, and one of the things I like to point out is take a look at this book on intersectionality. It's 376 pages. The book on critical race theory here is 528 pages. Why are they so big? They are so big because they have to make it really big to put in all this nonsense language and confusion so that anybody who's taken a political science class and in their third quarter and their 19th book, they're not really reading the book because it takes 100 pages to explain what could have been said in 10 pages. But if you read it in 10 pages, you say, well, this is nonsense. And of course, that's exactly what people back in the day said about Hegel. And that, I think that's important. So here we take a look at it. Critical theory is a neo-Marxist principle that envisions the total dissolution of the existing order through a series of dialectical negations. The Frankfurt School says Aufheben der Kultur, which translates as cancel culture. So the stuff that sounds old is immediately true. Intersectionality is the application of critical theory. It is consistent with Marx's call for the factual dissolution of the world order and the ruthless criticism of that order. Intersectionality follows the dialogue praxis process, which is the larger effort of this paper, and it is in line with the Frankfurt School. So let's take a look at what Marx said back in these writings, which I do believe this one is, I think I have the date here somewhere, 1843. This is quoting Marx. Criticism dealing with content is criticism in a hand-to-hand fight. Its objective is the point is to strike him. Okay. Every time they're in a discussion and debate with you, they're maneuvering to you to the point where they can strike you. If you disagree, you're confused if you're working with Marxists. The people must be taught to be terrified of itself. So I don't know. Doesn't that sound like Minneapolis and Seattle and Portland? I mean, this should sound familiar. So here I actually have the cancel culture thing right here. So you can see it. Let's continue with Karl Marx in 1843. By heralding the dissolution of the hitherto existing world order, the proletariat merely proclaims the secret of its own existence, for it is the factual dissolution of the world order. And later, in that same year, he said, if we have no business with the construction of the future or with organizing it for all time, there could be no doubt about the task confronting us at the present, the ruthless criticism of the existing order. Where you hear the word criticism, please understand Marxist destruction of your worldview. And that's what they mean by dialectical negation. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but for this briefing, you can go with that. Aufheben der Kultur can be translated council culture. And I'm going to see, can you see the code language here? Because I do have my code language here. So let's take a look. Dissolution can go to salve et coagula. That's going to be a future briefing. Proletariat. By the way, this is 25 or 6 years before Das Kapital was published. That's important because, as you'll see, this is the original Marx. The original still controlling definition of the proletariat is the dissolution of the existing world order. Nihilism. Please understand, When Marxists say they want to destroy the world to build a future perfect world, that's to get the people in the streets to agree with them. But they know they have no intention of constructing a future perfect world. All they want to destroy, all they want to do is destroy. And that's all they're intent on doing. We have no business with the construction of the future or with organizing it. Our only intent is to destroy the existing order. So that's important. All Marxists do, the only reason Marxists exist is to destroy, and they have nothing to replace it with. Ruthless criticism, that's critical philosophy. That's critical theory. In biblical history or biblical analysis, that's the historical critical approach. That should be ringing a bell with some people, okay? Whenever you see the word critical, it's concerned with the ruthless destruction through criticism. So all I'm saying is this stuff about Marx in the 1840s, that is center Marx, center mass Marx. It's ultimately the only thing that you really need to know about Marx. So let's do this interesting little segue about those things that influenced Marx back in the early 1840s. As the historical record amply documents, Marxism has a long and established record of leaders who'd rather be rulers in hell than subject in heaven. We have this quote here from Saul Alinsky saying he dedicated his book to Lucifer. I will argue that that's an homage to Karl Marx. Take a look in 1837. I wish to avenge myself against the one who rules above. Thus heaven I have forfeited. I would fall well. My soul, which is true to God, is chosen for hell. And then we go to another quote from Marx. If there is something which devours, I'll leap within it. Though I bring the world to ruins, the world which bulks between me and the abyss, I will smash to pieces with my enduring curses. If you think that I could only find two quotes about from Marx writing about Satan, you would be seriously wrong. So here we have those quotes, and I ask this question. It's really not professional for a professional analyst to look at this aspect of Marxism. But when does the chronic association associated with a worldview transition from being an interesting curiosity? Okay, here, Marx dedicates his writings to hell, his efforts to hell. And here you have Alinsky saying the same thing. And you could see that that's an homage. But you could see a couple of years ago, John Podesta having the bizarre spirit cooking. Then you can see that Black Lives Matter founder is not just a Marxist, but she is a cult leader, a genuine occult leader. I don't know how many people know that. And then here you have getting the nod in the Republican Party to run for the sheriff in New Hampshire, a Satanist, a transsexual Satanist anarchist. And finally, just to kind of clear it out, here are BLM rioters chanting, F Jesus. So the question I have to ask is, at what time, from a professional analytical point of view, does it transition from being an interesting curiosity to, and I see in the briefing slides, it's a little bit low here, to a legitimate object of analysis? So here we have 1844 Marx, and here's 1867 Das Kapital. Our understanding of Marx is based on Marx version 1.0. And we're not really looking at the 23 years later Marx 2.0, which I would argue is just an application. For example, in the original Marx, it's always been the center mass. It's the version of Marx that the Frankfurt School says they're using. They declared it the main effort in the 1920s, especially in America. It's the dominant form of Marxism confronting America today, and at least since the 1960s. A pure application of Hegel's Aufheben der Kultur formula using Marx's original concepts of the proletariat. And here what you have, if you just go with Das Kapital, is that does have an effect. It attracts the have-nots. But it creates for us a strategic distraction by always having to associate Marx today with Das Kapital when we don't even need to look at it. Here is Willy Munzenberg from the German Comintern, the Communist International in the 1920s. We must organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Only then, after they have corrupted its values and made life base, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat. And of course, we have another quote from Lukács. Who is Lukács? He's a Hungarian leader of the Communist Party who actually was part of this Hungarian SSR in the 1920s. And he is the spiritual grandfather of another famous Hungarian Marxist. Begins with an S, ends with an S, has an R in the middle. Well, let you guys figure that one out. I saw the revolutionary destruction of society as the one and only solution to the cultural contradictions of the epoch. They are committed to destroying Western culture. So we've all seen this definition of intersectionality, which is the same as critical race theory, or critical race theory is an application of intersectionality. And we've all seen the circular graphic here that the Marxists like to use to talk about it. You have this line of domination, and above is the evil stuff we do, and below are the things that offset it. So I want to take a look at that. I'm going to do something, and it's going to look a little contrived for a second. And I'm going to bring stuff from the other brief that you might not be familiar with. We'll just talk past it for right now. So here we have this idea of praxis, and it looks like a goalpost, but really it's just a symbol and a dotted line. And they're taking you from below the waterline where you're at, and their goal is to bring you up to the top to where they want you to think. And all the efforts in this over here is to kind of raise your understanding that way. And they're going to use this axis. And I'm going to show you that how they explain it. I'm going to show you how it is easy. All they did was take this line of domination right here, and they took the above wheel and they aligned it with the bottom wheel. And you see they line one thing up against another. So they'll say, hence, here we're going to take non-literal and we're going to put educationalism, okay? That's educationalism. And they're going to say everybody who engages in educationalism is, you know, against anybody who wants to do the top is against educationalism. Hence, educationalism is used to negate credential. That's what the word is here, credential. Sorry, because it's kind of blacked out here. So credentialed individuals have the authority and the status to be doctors, professors, engineers. That's educationalism. And you already hear that they're coming out and declaring that mathematics is white supremacy. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, think of all the non-white people who in the ancient world came up with the major concepts of mathematics, like the Egyptians and the Indians. I mean, it's ridiculous. So what you see is they're doing one to negate the other. The credentialed is negated by the non-literate. And all I'm doing is turning their thing upside down so you can see how it's a negation formula. And each one of them has that. So now you have fertile, and that will be counteracted by infertile. And that's called, and they're going to have non-pronatalism. If you are someone who believes in getting married and having a family, you're a pronatalist. And if that sounds contrived, well, it is contrived. And so I've just used these examples to show that here you have racism, and it comes up against concepts of racism. So that uses dark to offset white, and that's how it looks. So once intersectionality is exposed as an instrument of negation, they just use one to negate the other. Okay, there's really a better way to portray their silly graphic. And remember, we have that post. And let's just take a look at each of these little green wheels is an event where they destroy something, an element of American identity. And down below, you see racism, Eurocentrism, language bias, genderism, educationalism. All they do over a period of time is bring up people of color to destroy one concept. And then they bring up non-Euro origin. And each one of these, that's language bias. Then they bring up gender divergent to go after genderism. And then they go after educationalism to go after the non-literate. And you see, all they're doing is lining these things up to negate these values. Okay. And so LGBTQ is heterosexism. And so you'll see that it fades out over toward there because it's already been negated. So this is what they're doing. They're just canceling one thing out with another. This is what they mean by cancel culture. And when you show this graphic this way, even though the background stuff is explained in a different brief leading up to this, I'm sure you get the idea here. Light pale is pitted against dark and colorism. It's all about destroying the culture. So what we have are backdrop narratives. The dialectic, including binaries and personas, operate in the background and are often associated with backdrop narratives. You know, I'm going to skip this slide because for right now, I don't think we need to do it. I think I would have gotten rid of it if I had been fast enough on my feet. White supremacy is the most lethal threat to the U.S., DH draft assessment says. This is September 2020. Why does DHS orient its counterterror efforts on constructed mass line personas when real Marxist groups like Antifa and BLM are engaged in real street terror in the United States? And I just kind of run down this list right here, going back to the first appearance of the coexist bumper stickers and the hate bumper stickers. Positive personal and social attributes were identified and targeted from the minimization through the slow evolution of hostile narratives, populated by constructed personas. They created an opposite to negate it. That's the constructed persona, and designed to invert these positive attributes. As a part of mass line narrative development, negative personas are used to characterize the opposition in odious and undesirable terms. Obey us or be one of them. So now all of a sudden, to believe in the Constitution is to be a white supremacist. And therefore, if you believe in the Constitution, you are a white supremacist. And the only way you could prove you're not a white supremacist is to repudiate the Constitution. So that's what I mean by creating a negative to the Constitution, that's white supremacism. And of course, it negates it. And all you have to do is think about how you are a little worried when you're out in public defending the Constitution that someone might take a brick to your head. And in fact, we have video of someone taking bricks to people's head. So we're not in a period of our history where that is just a rhetorical force. Well, we all agree that white supremacy persona is designed to evoke KKK and neo-Nazi images. It's actually only used to attack average people who have average, normal American patriotic views. So now, does this start to make sense? Let's take intersectionality, Black Lives Matter, or critical race theory, the intersectionality variant of a Marxist dialectical negation, intersecting axes of privileges, domination, oppression. The science of reason is intersectionality. And they basically say anybody who gets in the way of those violent protests, because they called it a peaceful protest, you're the criminal who is going to be violent, because the BLM Antifa riots are called peaceful protest, and you will be arrested because you're the one disobeying the declaration by the state, who is God, saying, we say that's a peaceful protest, and if citizens want to protect their property, they will be arrested. And in fact, we saw that. And so what I'm trying to do is show you, because these pieces, this intersectionality is kind of made opaque. You don't see the clouds hiding marks in all these pieces. You're in a state of confusion because you see these things coming at you, and you don't know why it's hitting you or where it's coming from. And so you are only responding to what you have, which is what they call you. And because you're now in your home, you're isolated in your home because you can't go out and share your ideas with friends. You feel isolated when you want to defend the Constitution. But if Antifa wants to burn your city down, there are no sanctions. You see, that's what this is all about. And people need to understand it that way. There is COVID. My father died of it. But the COVID narratives used to enforce the shutdown are only tangentially related to COVID itself. And I'd like to point out that the most vulnerable people to COVID have never really been protected. And in fact, we have governors who put COVID patients on old folks' homes, the most vulnerable, and killed them by the tens of thousands it's looking at. So I would point out that separate in your mind COVID and the COVID narrative. So what we have here is the average person, he believes in the Constitution, the oath to support and defend, lawful orders, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and he's being attacked with dialectics, the state is God, science is reason. Well, how about if we call the science of reason intersectionality? That's fake science. How about if we say these peaceful protests, that the Constitution be imposed and your elected leaders impose the rule of law? How about we look at this dialectic and ridicule it? You see, once we simplify what they're doing, what we really see is that hidden behind all this scientific ease and mumbo jumbo, these people are paper tigers. If we understand the Marxist attack, you don't see it, but it's very dull. And as I hit the next one, you see our famous political warfare map emerging to show you that this is a classical political warfare paradigm. And if they're pushing into the end state, we can push back in this political warfare view. So I'm going to use this quote from a man named Bertrand Russell. And I think we're coming to a conclusion so that we can, you know, if we have time for questions, entertain them. But intersectionality is simply a Marxist negation formula, cancel culture formula. Anything they identify only exists to identify something you want to negate. So let me give you a non-critical race theory example. They know that if they attack Christians and Jews directly, faithful Christians and Jews, that they might run into a problem. But if they criminalize the expression of that faith and they do it over a slow period of time, okay, so you don't really kind of notice it's creeping in on you, all of a sudden you realize that if you're really a faithful person, you can't really become an executive in a corporation because you're not supporting the diversity narrative, but the diversity narrative only exists to negate you. Okay, so every one of those elements is something that means that if you're a Christian or if you're faithful, you can't believe that. And if you say you can, you're actually negating something. And it doesn't matter to them that you don't realize you did it till you're, 20 years into the negation and you forgot what you were supposed to believe. So I'm linking up this, what we see. Remember, I'm telling you, these are huge books, these critical race theory books and these intersectionality books. They're really big. So I want to use this quote that Bertrand Russell has about Hegel. And I want you to understand it's a one for one. Hegel's philosophy is so odd that one would not have expected him to be able to get sane men to accept it. But he did. He set out with so much obscurity that people thought it must be profound. You don't want to read critical race theory in your political science class and pretend you don't get it. Oh, I get it. And then you go obey. Hegel can easily be expounded lucidly in words of one syllable, but then its absurdity becomes obvious. My only point is, because critical race theory is Marxism and Marxism comes from Hegel, it's the same. And I just like to point out something, maybe if there's ever interest, that there is something called an initiate language that has two meanings to words. And the people who are inside the club know what those words mean. And they could say something and you might think it sounds crazy or silly, but you don't know what it means. And I'll just use one example. When your elected leader said, this is a peaceful protest, what they were saying to other people who understood what that meant was, you could protest as violently as you want because we have declared your movement peaceful. And therefore, when a woman with her 2-year-old child in her car is having it rocked, they will tell her that's a peaceful protest. That happened. Or when someone gets a gun and stands on front of his porch to defend his home, he is going to be arrested. Those elected leaders set out the word telling those people on the street that they were protected. So that was what we'll call initiate language, that they knew the code. And you could say, this is not a peaceful protest. Are they crazy? But you didn't get it. And you responded like the non-initiate. And so it's about understanding how that works. So we go back to a famous philosopher who was alive during Hegel and hated Hegel. In Germany, it was possible to proclaim as the greatest philosopher of all ages, Hegel, a repulsive, mindless charlatan, an unparalleled scribbler of nonsense. Scribbles nonsense, okay? And for 20 years, many thousands have believed it stubbornly and firmly, and indeed, even outside Germany. Well, I would argue that Marxism and all these concepts like critical race theory that follow from it are the scribblings of repulsive, mindless charlatans. Unparalleled scribblers of nonsense. And we have to call it out as nonsense. And I will tell you, you could go to such famous people like Booker T. Washington, who was calling the same thing out back in the, I'm trying to remember when he wrote his book, 1911, of people who are making money off of racism. And with that, I will end with this quote from George Orwell. What you see with critical race theory is the demand that you say that 2 + 2 = 5. And if you do not, we're going to go after you and we're going to punish you. We're living in a society where we're demanding that people say 2 + 2 = 5. And with that, I will take questions and I'll even get back into the picture so I can be the star of my own show. But what I think is really important to link to is we need to understand that when you see Antifa with all this, crazy, occult stuff, that we shouldn't think that they're Marxists. Oh, and they have this crazy occult stuff, that's been a part of it from the beginning. And I think we could overstate it, but I think we should never understate it or leave it out of the equation. And it kind of sets the scene for that. Do you have any questions? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a large lead that I think what I can do is I can broadcast questions in the room in the chat box. Here we go. Yeah, so I know I have an echo.
I'll turn off my mic until I answer.
Okay, great. Okay, let me see here. Question for Steve. Where'd it go? Okay, this is going to broadcast to the room. Okay, there it is.
Was there a question?
Yeah, look in the chat box.
Oh, I'm looking for the chat box.
Over on the right.
Well,
it is on my screen.
I don't get a chat box on mine. I'm looking. Let's see. Okay. I have a thing. There's something else to the side. So if you just read it, I'll answer it.
Let me see if I can. Okay, it is. What is the best way to get this message to the citizenry?
Well, I will tell you, if this sounds difficult, I'm going to tell you it is. And I think there's kind of I think that we need to educate groups and have groups themselves educate down. And because I do think it gets a little complicated. But I do think that there's things that could be put out that is very simple to understand. I don't know how complicated this was for the average person. I do it enough so I take for granted things that I understand when I talk to people who are smart as me. And I realized I just talked by them. You know, what were you just saying? So how do we get this to it? I think we need to make a deliberate decision to understand Marxism. You saw something that was briefed before here in the large brief. And the name of this briefing, the big one, is called Dialogue in a Period of Praxis. And what I want to point out, the reason I think the quote is so important at the very beginning, where I show that in the 1840s that to destroy culture, they had to destroy God, is that all this left-wing movement from the very beginning has always been about that from the beginning. And so if you look closely at the slides, I don't know if it comes through in the PowerPoint, in the back it says Dialogos Kai Praxis in Greek. And this method is as old as the Old Testament. Okay, this process that we're seeing can be shown to be referenced in the Acts of the Apostles. I mean, I have slides that take something from the Acts of the Apostles and shows there it is, right there. And I'll show that in the Greek word, they're using a Greek word that instantly will clarify what they mean. Okay, here, dialogue and praxis. And the reason I'm saying that isn't because I want to go all the way back to the Bible. It's to get people to understand that what you're seeing is an application of a strategy. Now, everything in this briefing really is about how they created this mechanism to destroy religion. And the Marxists just appropriated it. And I don't want to go into detail about that, but this model was designed to do it. And right before this section of the brief, or a couple sections before, there's the period called Dialogue Period of Praxis. What that is they institute these things without telling you. Let me give you an example. Political correctness from the very beginning is Marxism, but they institute political correctness without calling it Marxism until you buy off on enough politically correct ideas without understanding it's Marxism, that when they escalate political correctness to hate speech, when they start attacking you, you're still trying to figure out why that is. And you might have forgotten what your own church was teaching before political correctness came in, because we don't talk about that anymore. And if we do talk about it, the plate's a little light coming in. And I'm trying to steer this your way on this. But so a key point is this dialogue in a period of praxis was how you introduced into a church a little thing here and let that dissolve. And don't say what it is. Just say, we have to be a big tent. And if you want to be a big tent, you also have to look at this view. And that big tent concept is the what I'll call the dialectic negation, the piece that causes the cancel culture. And so that's very complicated. But I do think, how do we get this out? We teach pieces of it that are easily understood. But we also have to get people to enough people to understand how it comes together, that this all feeds into that Marxist triangle of the three things that you need to attack strategically. And you need to recognize it when it comes into your church or synagogue. I know we have a rabbi on this right now listening in on you, so I want to make sure I'm inclusive. Go ahead.
I'm struck that we need to do the point. If it looks like the left, Marxist, whatever you want to call them, are attempting to make everything true, that's what they're doing.
Everything is an aversion. So when you hear critical historical approach to biblical analysis, that means it only exists to negate the Bible. That's just the bottom line is you might not be able to figure out how they did it. You might not be able to figure out what the point is. But once you understand it's called critical historical approach, you know what the goal is. And that's kind of what we need to figure out how to bottom line something for people. And I'm trying to think of the example I used yesterday, but you know, I'm going to alibi myself. I'm in a chemo fog a little bit. So the example was, I'm trying to think of an example where I'm saying, I'm trying to think of what the example was I used. It'll come, if it comes to me, I'll cut you off and just tell you what it is. But the idea is we could go deep on this, but once you see this, that's all you need to know. All you need to know is it's here to destroy you. So like for the example is if, one of the things I was discussing with a couple ministers was, on this big tent thing, I said, every one of the epistles in the New Testament, and over half of them was the only reason they were written, are about saying we have these people coming into our church to do this or that to steer them wrong. Did Paul, did Peter, did John say, guys, we got to be a big tent and be inclusive? Mm-hmm. Or did they say, kick them out and don't let the door hit them on the way out? And my point is, inclusivity is an attack on pure belief. And you could pick what you want to purely believe in, but that's the whole concept, that you have to be so big that you believe in everything. And what do we know about people who believe in everything? They believe in nothing. So I have to remember to look in the camera because I keep looking at you, Bill. That's okay. So is there another question?
Yeah, I'm looking here.
And I'll get close to the camera so I'm not,
That was the answer. I wanted to ask, so there's a sense that, there's a lot of intimidation going on right now with BLM, Antifa, and some of these revolutionary groups. And, there's a lot of fear that accompanies that in the culture. And so the temptation is to be retiring and to go and hide and to comply and not to make waves. But it strikes me that we should be doing the exact opposite of that. Would you comment on that?
I think we're in a situation where we have to be very careful because I think on the one hand, I think you're right that we have to come out and do something. On the other hand, I think that we're in a situation where if we pop our head up, they know where we're most likely to pop our head up and they're going to whack us like whack-a-mole. And so they have us in the kill zone. I'm using military language. And they have the higher ground. So I think that, yes, I think we have to respond, but I also think we have to be very smart about it. And I think we have to figure out how they're going to, what we think their response is going to be, and how we can respond to that. And so I think one of the things that we're hitting on, and if I'm stepping on toes here, I will apologize, but not really, I would like to point out that you saw Republican leader after Republican leader line up on January 6th and 7th condemning their base, okay? And I have yet to hear any of them condemn these cities being burned down. And I think it's really important that when we look at what were the dogs that are not barking, and they're really not barking at a level that they're giving you any assurance, are the Republicans we elected who are supposed to be on our side not showing up for the game at all. I would argue that because these impeachments were contrived and they were extra legal, just appearing at these impeachments meant they were giving the processes themselves legitimacy. And what they were given legitimacy was a show trial environment. And, you know, guess what? I don't think anybody on this call is a president or is a high caliber persona. So they could squash us like bugs in this whole thing. So people will say what defense they gave in the impeachments. I would say they validated an impeachment process where you had the head of the House Permanent Select Committee have secret hearings. Well, how un-American is that? So I'm going off on a segue here, but I'm saying when we plan what we're going to do, we're on severe notice that the people we elected to give us to protect our view are in every way that matters, including it was Republican districts that backed up the election for the Democrats. You know, that our side in Congress doesn't seem to be on our side. And so, you know, that might sound like an overreach for some, but that's how I'm scoring it right now. So to answer what do? We have to be smart. And, you know, our point at Unconstrained Analytics, and we put it in writing in a paper, in a big, big paper called Re-Remembering the Misremembered Left, was that the Republican leadership had become a controlled opposition of the left. Why? Because they obey the politically correct narrative. And the politically correct narrative is cultural Marxism. So whenever a Republican is more interested in condemning someone for racism, sexism, homophobia, he's doing that at the expense of the First Amendment, and he's doing that at the expense of the protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what you see this last summer was a complete collapse of that. I think people need to take that in. I was going to make another point there, but I think I got that point through. So next question, please.
So along that vein, I'm looking for questions. Something you've said to me that Republicans have become the defeat. Explain that to people who may not know what that means. Is that what you just explained?
Yes. What I will say is in a political analysis, when you're fighting a battle, you say, here's an infantry platoon, here's our mortars, here's our tanks, here's our artillery. What piece do we move on the checkboard at a certain point in a battle that causes the other side to be defeated? Okay. Now our point is, going back to the re-remembering paper, is that the left cannot succeed in their mission of disenfranchising the American base unless they are first demoralized. And the mission of demoralization is the mission they've given to the Republican Party. Now, if you go and ask your Republican friends whether that's the mission they accepted, they'll violently protest, and they'll say, who is this guy? And he's a crazy guy. I'm not saying they accept it because they say we accept this message. They accept the message because they obey the narrative. Once you obey a Marxist command and control narrative, you are their asset. Okay? So they believed, and I'll challenge you here. We put it in writing 2 years before the election. Okay, that they are the ones who assess that, so they are such a controlled opposition that we will depend on them to institutionalize our gains. They will be the ones who will make it impossible to challenge an election. I would argue that even if an investigation into the election fraud turned out that nothing happened, which I am very doubtful of, I would still argue the outcry is so loud it demands an investigation. And the idea that our side is shutting their base out for that, So they're the ones that are demoralizing the base for the left. The left's job, the left's mission is to disenfranchise you from your own American institutions. Your students, college students, have been disenfranchised from the colleges. Your kids in grade school are being taught Marxism through the mechanism of Black Lives Matter, the critical race theory. So do you see any Republicans really stopping this? No. So because the people who voted for Republicans voted to stop this and they're not stopping it, the left properly gambled that as a controlled opposition, they are so reliably on our side that they will execute the mission we need them to demoralize you. I'm, you know, looking at you, and I want to point to demoralize you. Okay,
every one of us.
That they did do that, and that's where they're at. And so I go back to your first question, Bill. How do we stand up and fight back when we know that we're not only up against their side, but we have to contend with the fact that our side is not where they're supposed to be. Okay.
And we need to stop importing with the narrative.
The narrative is cultural Marxism, and as such, it needs to be understood that way.
I mean, soon they're coming with guns, and it's I don't think it's that far off. And I think our situation, and this is just sort of the forward-looking part of me, that, and you know, an informed forward-looking part, but I think what comes next is, you know, it's after the Night of Broken Glass and the killings and the roundings up and so forth. I mean, these guys are really intent. This is a real Marxist revolution, and it has to get violent because that's just what it does. I mean, that's what Marxists do. And I think it started back in the Garden of Eden, actually.
Well, if, you know, I'm going to be a professional, non-religious guy answering your question.
Well, that's okay.
I'm joking when I say this, but you know, if the Marxists want to be affiliated, let's just say Marxists don't believe in any of the satanic symbolism they openly adopt, but they openly adopt it. And I will argue, because you don't analyze that, you're missing something. And I will argue that the way they use the dialectic has, you know, some, let's just say, esoteric background to it. But once you say that they are leaning on, you know, satanic symbology, and they allow themselves to be associated with that symbolically, then you kind of do have a Garden of Eden analogy. And you could make that analogy as an atheist to an atheist, because that's what they're doing. And we don't need to have any. What I'm getting at is, even if you're an atheist talking to another atheist, if you're not picking up on the symbols they're using, you're just simply wrong. And then then you would say, well, then maybe it is going back to the Garden of Eden, because they're drawing that picture, you know, and because they're drawing that picture, you need to account for that picture. Even if you account for it by saying it doesn't mean anything, well, I would argue that's wrong. Okay. You still have that. And so in a case most unfavorable to a biblical analysis of Marxist, you know, leaning on satanic symbols, you can still show that that analysis needs to be had. And because they're leaning on that symbology, you can go back to the Garden of Eden. How's that? Does that hit your
That's
point?
Great. I think what I basically, one of the things I'm saying is, you know, Jesus called the Pharisees your father's devil. I don't think he meant that. And I think that when someone who is a politician lies or shades the truth or, you know, steers things in a counterfeit direction by whatever means, then they are a tyrant. Anyone that does that is a tyrant. Transparency in government is anti-tyrant. And so that's what I think. And I think that all tyrants have a tyrant's problem. Father of tyrants.
This is something that I struggle with, because I'm going to go back and hit the same, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. You know, the biggest difference between the Republicans and the Democrats right now is if you're a Democrat and you're upset with what they're doing, my answer is knock, knock, guys. What were they not communicating that you didn't realize that they were Marxist in their intent? But I think the difference is, and I'm bringing up the tyranny thing, is what makes the Republicans different is that I don't believe they're rhinos. Or, I mean, I'm sure there are some cowardly Republicans in the backbench, but they're cowardly in that they cower to the leadership that holds leadership positions and stuff like that out. That the Republicans are the ones that run on your issues, knowing they have no intention of ever doing that. And the question I have, and this is where I will just disagree with people. You know, when they had the House and the Senate and the executive and this Trump administration where they got in on a series of issues and none of them got done, just please don't tell me that there were, you know, please don't tell me when you have a majority that somehow you got stopped by people who are in the minority. And so I just think that, you know, we have this severe issue with the left. These Marxists are in a united front. That's a Marxist term, a united front with the Islamic movement. And I think we showed that when we saw street violence in some places, it was Muslim Brotherhood groups running the street violence show. So they're ready. They're ready. Our side that says they're on our side and only agrees with our issue to get the nod. What's the first thing that happens once, you know, you go to a MAGA district and you get the nod from the district gives this guy the nod because he says he's on your side? What's the first thing the Republican Party says? They said, now we have to move to the middle. But if you're coming from the conservative side, all moves to the middle are always moves to the left. And then what happens if they get elected? They say they have to move to the middle again to reach an agreement. Well, the first thing they did when they moved to the middle after getting getting a ticket from you is they moved to the left. So what did the Republicans do right there? They just disenfranchised you. Okay. And what are you told? Well, this is as good as it gets. And I'm raising the specter on tyranny. Where is this tyranny coming from? Is it coming from the Democrats? Because the Democrats have been beaten on this issue multiple times in the last 20 years. And we put people in office to stop it. And what you notice is that did not happen, and it didn't happen at all. And in fact, arguably, it didn't even slow it down. And so when we talk about tyranny, where is that coming from? And are we disenfranchised? Are we being disenfranchised the moment when we say it's as good as it gets? Are we accepting our own negation? And I think that's why this whole dialectical thing becomes real, because when you recognize it that way, you see that the first level of Marxist negation of your worldview came with the party that was running and got your ticket on your issue. And the first thing they said is we have to move to the middle. So I don't know if that's answering your question. There is tyranny. And I think that we're seeing that I think that we're in a period right now where we're recognizing tyranny. And I'm asking myself, how long has it been that way? And we're just recognizing it. You know, there is a president who just left office, and we have people who work for him directly who are now saying they directly disobeyed orders and didn't do what he asked or ordered as the president of the United States. And I find that chilling. And if they could do that to a president, I think we're speed bumps on the road. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. I think that in many ways, the church is the only the true church, the church triumphant, if you will, is the only entity that can possibly regain, really take this back. It's got to be based in truth. And I think that in many ways, in evangelical Christianity in America in the last 50 years, we have progressively disenfranchised ourselves by giving up our right to speak and by believing the lies that we've been told. As you know, for instance, separation of church and state, that is a lie. And that I've been saying this recently, the Johnson Amendment did more to sink this nation under tyranny than any other strategy the enemy has used in my lifetime. That actually came the year I was born. So I think it started long before I was born, probably at least in this century, long before I was born. And I think it's time to speak up, and I think it's time to, even if it's going to cost something, and it probably will, we have to speak up. Pastors have got to start opening their mouths and addressing what's happening in culture, what's happening in civil society, what's happening in government. If it looks like tyranny, it is. I mean, we're being asked to believe that everything we see and hear in nature, you know, in the laws of nature, that which is the truths that are written in the creation, are not truths. To believe that a man can be a woman can be a man, and we just can't tolerate that anymore, in the least. Anyway, I'll shut up.
Well, I think that the fact of biology tells you that the genetic sequencing is hard mathematically based science. I mean, it's very hard to refute, and it tells you that you are born either a male or a female. Cell biology tells you exactly the same thing, and in fact, all of the human race depends on there being the two to move the species forward, if you want to, you know, sound crypto, you know, pseudoscientific. And so the idea that you create gender and you basically have that compete with real science, you know, the word pseudo in Greek means false. So when you say pseudoscience, I would say the science of gender is that ideology-based scientific view. Remember the science of reason? And I think that the people at the top of that pyramid know it's nonsense. And they know they're imposing it on you as 2 + 2 = 5. And they know that you, if you're a person of faith, they know that you, by accepting this, are compromising something you believe. I think it's very important for us to be very careful how we move forward. I'm not advocating violence. But, you know, one of the things I think is important is that we have become spectators in our own destruction. And what I mean by that, this is why I'm not advocating I'm saying this, but not in a violence, like I'm calling for violence, is, you know, we love to look at Washington kneeling in the snow at Valley Forge before he's going to do what? Go into actual battle to fight for what he believes. Okay? What do? We say we're fighting the battle because we're watching Hannity. We are making ourselves passive spectators in our own domain. I happen to think that people need to stop watching the 24-hour news cycle, because just watching that already poisons what you're doing and thinking, because even if it's on a line you agree with, you're adopting what some corporation is telling you how to think about something, and it has the effect, no matter whether you agree with it or not, of eliminating your ability to look at events yourself and make up your own mind. And as we saw with Fox in this last presidential election, people like me were warning about it years in advance. They are not who you think they are. And so people feel betrayed. And my point is, why are you feeling betrayed? Why are you feeling betrayed? Because they upset your evening in between popcorn, you know, getting popcorn while you're watching TV. So I do think we need to really start becoming active at how we're going to understand the world. And I think we have to actively go out and get the information. Don't, if you're waiting for information to come to you, that information was made by somebody else to come to you. And you already should be saying, why do I want to believe this? It's time to start going out and getting the information and checking the information. In that regard, on our side, we are just getting killed. We are getting wiped out by people buying into disinformation. I mean, whether it's the left or other players, and I won't get into other players, are much closer to home, okay? They just have to put a fragment of a worm on a big hook, and they know that despite the fact you see the hook, you see the 1 millimeter of worm, you're still going to bite on that. And what they're doing is they're destroying us because they're feeding us disinformation. It's something we want to believe. It's from people we think we believe because somebody on Fox or somebody in a newspaper said, you can depend on them. And my question is, did you ever hear this guy a year ago? No. Why are you putting your faith in this guy today? And when you get tired of him, just notice another guy pops up and you just jump from person to person. If you hear someone tell you, I can't tell you now because we're going to go to court. I can't tell you now because it's sensitive. But this guy is bad. You believe me. And then you start jumping on how bad these other people are, and you elevate this guy to a saint, and he's the guy you're going to fall into, and 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, nothing. And all of a sudden, you're being attacked for you know, biting off on disinformation. So I think that we, if we really are going to get steely-eyed and learn how to fight back to your first question, I'm kind of rounding around coming to your first question, we have to understand the other side knows what we bite on. They're going to feed it to us and are going to use it to discredit us. So we need to stop depending on news programming that's paid for. The same people who pay for ads on Fox News pay for it on MSNBC. Okay? And there's a sense in which that's kind of all you need to know. And we need to start going out and getting the information. We need to start getting with people who are like-minded and will advance the ball. And I think that we need to understand that the way we're understanding these threats is too shallow. We're fighting the left in the kiddie pool at 1 foot, and the pool we need to be in is 10 feet deep, and we need to fight in that pool, and we need to generate depth, and we need to generate intensity, and we need to generate, you know, you don't win the fight when you hit them first. It's when they respond to you, and then you can respond back. That you're the boxer. If you're a boxer, it's not how good you are in the first round. It's whether you're still standing in the sixth round. And our people tend to want to fight the first round. The second round starts, they get clocked. They say, well, I'm done. I didn't expect that. And so I think that we kind of, you know, we're exactly where the other side wants us to be. And we're in bad shape. And so I think in terms of coming out in the fight and what you're saying, because I do think we need to do that. I also think we need to start, you know, get to a higher level of intensity and understand if we're going to save this country, we have to be a lot more serious and a lot more deliberate and a lot more threat focused than we are right now.
Sorry about that. That was operator error. I was saying that I agree. That's really good. I think it's not what's happening. I guess I want to say to everybody is not a fait accompli. It's not a lost battle. And you know, Jesus may be coming back. He could come back in the next 5 minutes, and that'll be great. But you know, we're probably going to be living through whatever is happening. And I think that, you know, this is the America is now the bed we have made. That our preceding generations and our generations have made. And, you know, I think in the economy of God and knowing the character of God, he's not going to let us destroy a country through passivity and then take us out of the mess we made. I think it's more likely in the character of God that we're going to suffer through it, or we're going to win it back on our own effort on the with God, but obviously by putting our heart and soul into it. And liberty is worth that, I think. It's worth fighting for. At least for my kids. So I'm gonna end with that. And Steve, I think I'm gonna end it. I don't see a lot of other specific questions to you, but if I do get any, I'll send them to you and you can answer them. And folks, I will send out the notes. I will send out the chat session so you get all the links, and also send out Steve's presentation to all of you. So thanks for being with us today, Steve.
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
I think what you're saying needs to be built on, because what you're saying is very true. We're in a situation where they're making you feel like you're isolated and a minority, and we're still the majority. And we need to remember that. And we need to remember they're something of the small snake trying to swallow the big dog. Okay. And so there's a lot that can go wrong with what they're doing. It's just like the Germans early on being full of fake stuff. Fake bravado, and all anybody had to do, all the British and the French had to do, was say "boo," and the Germans would have gotten rid of Hitler. And I say that because we're big; they're keeping us isolated with this COVID narrative. We have to be smart on how we fight back on that. We need to be correct. I think on the COVID narratives, we own the medical, and the scientific argument, not them. And we need to demand our local politicians, especially in Republican-controlled areas, we need to remind them that to take away some right, I think everybody admits, would agree, that if we saw people dropping dead of an epidemic every third house, we should be under this type of lockdown. The problem is, if you take out the elderly and the vulnerable, you know, people like me with no immune system right now, that this, the people dying of COVID are the same people who die of pneumonia and flu. And that's a tragedy and some others. But this is not an epidemic that's what that puts the population at risk. And it never was. And so I think we need to start asking our elected politicians, what is the scientific criteria by which they're locking us down? Because I believe that the COVID lockdown has to do with imposing Marxist mass line narratives. And all you need to do to confirm this is watch YouTube say that they're following the social media, saying they're obeying the WHO talking points. Well, the WHO is run by a Marxist, and the Marxists are imposing Marxist speech laws, which our media and social media are enforcing. And by the way, the head of the United Nations is a Marxist. So when you see even President Trump allowing U.S. social media to impose non-U.S. speech codes against Americans inside the United States, why aren't we telling our elected officials that they took an oath to support and defend the Constitution? The First Amendment is part of the Constitution, and they need to defend that against foreign speech laws that are being imposed under color of authority by our social media. So I just wanted to double down on what you said, Bill, because the idea that we're a minority in our own country is not true, and it only becomes true if they get us to believe it. And with that, I would really like to thank you, Bill, and the Black Robe Regiment for having me on your webinar today.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's time. And, you know, God bless you. Thank you. I want to pray right now before we go. Turn me off so I can pray. Lord, we pray for Steve today. Pray that you would be with him. I pray, Lord, for his complete healing. God, I pray that you drive every bit of cancer out of his body. And, Lord, do a miracle. Lord, your word tells us clearly that God is, you are the same yesterday, today, and forever. So we believe that. We believe that with every fiber of our beings. And Lord, we ask you for a miracle on behalf of Steve. And we thank you for being with us today in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thanks for being with us.